Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. For this week's episode, we're joined by journalist Nikki Sava to discuss the inside story of the Liberal Party's surprise federal election win. Here's our host, Sally Warhaft.
It is just a tremendous pleasure to have Nikki Sava back with us tonight to talk about her new book and her experiences over the past little while. Nikki has been a guest on the Fifth Estate before, when she wrote this classic, The Road to Ruin. Of course, you all know her work for The Australian, on Insiders regularly. She's been in Canberra now in the press gallery. Is it really 40 years? Is that possible? Well, you must have been an infant when began.
Just out of primary school.
Nikki has been awarded by the Melbourne Press Club a Lifetime Achievement Award for her outstanding coverage of Australian politics. She really is one of our most treasured and intelligent and insightful observers and commentators, and it really is a pleasure. So welcome again.
Thank you. Thank you.
I brought both books. I mean, tonight we're here to talk about Plots and Prayers, but I had another look at The Road to Ruin. And honestly, these books don't even want to sit next to each other on the bookshelf.
They should be companions.
They should be, but they hate each other. The Road to Ruin, I realised, was sort of a really weird kind of Wallace Simpson-esque love story. But Plots and Prayers is just a story of hate. That's how I read it, and I loved it, but it was a difficult book to read because of the venom that is through it. And I just wondered, was it difficult to write?
It was incredibly difficult to write, a lot more difficult than The Road to Ruin. I wrote The Road to Ruin in 3 months, literally just sort of sped right through it. But with Plots and Prayers, it took me about double that, and it was made more difficult because there were so many characters involved and there was so much going on in the different camps, and so many people plotting and praying and stabbing and, you know, doing all the terrible things that politicians have to do if they want to scratch their way to the top. And it was hard to piece it all together and, you know, to try and make sense of it all beyond, you know, asking, well, why did you do it? And that was really my first question to people, why?
I wrote a list, as I underlined it as I went along, each person you asked, because everyone you interviewed you asked why, and it was... Oh, it was horrible. It was but we'll get to the whys. But let's begin really with some of the main characters, and we better start with Turnbull, so he, you know, doesn't, you know, kill himself. We better talk about him first. I think the great sort of victim, I suppose, of this tale, depending on how you see it. He always seemed to me like a work in progress as Prime Minister, that I still don't really know what he was about. So tell us what your sense of him was as a person, as a Prime Minister, behind that media non-image almost.
Well, I think the great problem, of course, was that people expected that he would be a certain kind of Prime Minister, and he turned out to be a very different Prime Minister. And not only because there were issues that everybody thought he stood for, like climate change, like same-sex marriage, which he did not prosecute probably as fully or as honestly as people expected him to, but also because there were so many problems that were left over from the Abbott era. And a lot of his time as Prime Minister was spent cleaning up the messes that Abbott had left. So by the time that was done, by the time the overflow, excuse me, from the 2014 budget was dealt with, along with, you know, various other issues, education funding, and then also the same-sex marriage plebiscite as well, there was very little of his own agenda that he could actually pursue. So I think if he had had more time in the job, if he had perhaps won a little bit better than he did in 2016, we would have seen a little bit more of the real Malcolm. But I think it was a half-finished picture by the time he left.
So there is a real Malcolm?
There is definitely a real Malcolm, and but there are sort of two real Malcolms.
Mm, how fascinating.
There's, you know, there's the Malcolm who is intelligent and charming and humorous and generous and all those things. But there's also a kind of an insecure Malcolm as well, I think, a very diffident type of character. And he can be very abrupt with people and very brusque with them. And he intimidates people too, to a certain extent. And they're sometimes, you know, a bit hesitant about telling him what they really think, which is not always a good thing. So, you know, there's competing personalities in there.
And that's it, even though he comes across as a prime minister who really sought other people's opinions, perhaps even too much, that it would make him indecisive.
That was a problem in itself. One of the overhanging problems from the Abbott era was that cabinet processes had been abandoned, because basically it was Abbott outsourcing the prime ministership to Peter Credlin, and they between them decided, you know, what would be done. And Malcolm had also been seared by his experience the first time around, where he went out way too far ahead of his own party on climate change and lost his job as a result. So he was determined this time to have proper cabinet processes, and he always said that his main advisers were his ministers. And so everything went through cabinet, everybody was consulted, but at some point the Prime Minister has to make the decision, the Prime Minister has to lead. And there were times when the ministers felt that he wasn't doing that.
Mm. Just before we get to his slaying, what do you think his legacy is beyond marriage equality? Is there anything else there?
Well, I do think education funding, Gonski 2.0, was something that, you know, he looks back on as an achievement and a worthwhile one. I think Snowy 2.0 also. Winning the 2016 election, even by the small margin that it was, that was an achievement, although it wasn't quite seen in that way, because there is no doubt, I think, and also the more sensible people inside the Liberal Party believe that there is no way that Abbott would have won that election, so it would have been a one-term government.
Mm. Let's turn to what happened. And you write in the book that, you know, there's one lesson, it's Churchill's saying, you never resign and you never give up. Never, ever vacate the leadership. What you tell us about those sort of eight mad days that went on that undid Malcolm Turnbull shows a remarkable lack of political intuition, I thought, and nous. His political instincts were sort of hopeless, I thought. Is that, am I being a little unfair?
Not entirely. No, well, that was one of the things about Malcolm. I thought that I did think he was a good prime minister because he was, you know, basically a decent person, and he had, you know, he had a program of things that he wanted to do, but he was a terrible politician. And these days you have to be both. And he didn't have the confidence within himself to deal with strength with the people in the party who opposed him, particularly the hard right and the capital C Conservatives. He should have dealt with them with a firmer hand, I think. He should have used his authority early on to establish his ascendancy over them, and he didn't do that, and that was a bad political call.
I don't think he was a good prime minister. I sort of feel like it's not enough, the things you've outlined there, to say this person was a really, you know, good prime minister, a bad politician. I just always felt, and I felt it in his incarnation as the first time as leader of the Liberal Party. You know, most prime ministers, they're elected, and it's like they've put on a sort of magical coat, and somehow they're lifted into something a little more, something a little different to those around them. And it was as if he never wore that coat. He never was elevated into leadership. And I'd sort of like to know a little bit more about why you do praise him, because you do in the book as well.
So I think it takes a while to get the hang of the job, right? And I guess I'm also comparing to what preceded.
Fair enough, yes.
So compared to Abbott, I thought, yes, obviously did a much better job. Compared to Julia Gillard, did a much better job. Compared to Kevin Rudd, did a much better job. Kevin Rudd made the apology to the stolen generation, but he had no legacy really beyond that.
The global financial crisis, I think I'd have to say would be one, wouldn't it?
Well, that was, I thought, good on the one hand and bad on the other, because he went way beyond what was needed and spent a lot more than was needed and wasted a lot more money than he should have. He could have done it, still got us through, but in a much more responsible way. So I think that's, yes, half a good story, but not a completely good story. I think there was way too much money wasted during that period, and, you know, we're still paying a price for that now. He promised to reform health, and he never actually got around to that either. So, I thought he fell short of what people expected.
One of the things you realise in the sort of tumultuous week where Turnbull was fighting to save his job is that there were several very, very sort of clear moments that you identify where he really could have saved it, it seems to me, two in particular. One, of course, was vacating the leadership, but the other one, which Morrison brings up very much to his defence in terms of Morrison's involvement, that he simply could have just told everyone to go home on the Thursday. Tell us about those events and why you think he might have missed the mark, or whether it was just inevitable that he was going to go.
I think there was an inevitability to it, because it was clear that Abbott was never going to let up, that he was never going to stop the campaign against him of destabilisation and sabotage, and he used energy as the weapon against him on the NEG. It wouldn't have mattered what Turnbull had put together on the NEG. It would never have been enough to satisfy Abbott and his followers. And also, if it hadn't been that, it would have been religious freedom. So they would have, if that had been settled, then they would have gone to the next thing. Dutton also was quite frank when I spoke to him about his timetable, and it was no idle talk on his part. He was getting ready to make a move against Turnbull when the next news poll was released, the 40th news poll. So he knew it was going to be brought on, so he could either sit there and wait for them to bring it on, or he could do it himself. So either, you know, die on his knees or live on his feet, and he decided to live on his feet. Now, Morrison advised him against that as well, said to him, whatever you do, don't bring your leadership into play. But he did. And as soon as he did that, as soon as he vacated his leadership and 35 of his colleagues voted against him, that was the end of him.
It's remarkable what Dutton did sort of plan and what he didn't plan at all. I mean, I was just astounded that he'd almost basically booked the prime ministerial aircraft for the day after. You know, he goes to bed on the Thursday night assuming he's going to be prime minister on the Friday morning, and his plan was to fly out on the Friday on the prime ministerial plane to go and visit drought-stricken farmers.
Yes.
I mean, that was the level of detail.
Was convinced. He was convinced on Thursday night, based on what is unclear, because the numbers were not there for him, but he was convinced that he had them. And he was on the Sunday night when he flew to Canberra from Brisbane to attend a special meeting of the cabinet on energy. He and Stephen Chobo shared the flight down, and he went through Chobo, or with Chobo, his master plan. And he told Stephen Chobo that he and Matthias Cormann had war-gamed everything. Matthias was fully on board with his plan, and he was convinced, they had gone through the numbers, and he was convinced he had the numbers.
So what then in this was the relationship, do you think, between Abbott and Dutton? I mean, it seems to me Abbott is the villain, the true villain of this story, of which there are several, but in terms of a just this iron will to make sure Malcolm Turnbull didn't succeed, whatever the cost, including his own sense of self-respect, I'd say, and certainly including his seat, as it turned out. But what was their relationship in all of this, Dutton's and Abbott's?
Abbott created the circumstances that enabled Dutton to make his move. He so undermined and weakened Turnbull that Turnbull, you know, was obviously in a very weakened position, and the circumstances were right for Dutton to have a go. So he wasn't officially Dutton's stalking horse, but that was the role that he played.
Let's go back to, I mean, they interwine these characters throughout this story to, it's like sort of reading about a really dysfunctional family, I suppose. Morrison wants people to believe that it never occurred to him that this might have happened up until the week, if not the days, before it did happen. Do you believe him or not?
I think Morrison is the most astute politician of his generation, and he knew exactly what was going on. He could read the party as well as anybody else, and he could see that a move against Turnbull was inevitable because of the way that Abbott and Abbott's great media mates, the Alan Joneses, the Ray Hadleys, the Andrew Bolts, were conducting the campaign day after day after day. And he knew that that would all come to a head. And also many of his key lieutenants were from Queensland, and they knew Dutton very well as well, and they knew the forces that were in play in Queensland. So they didn't know exactly when something would happen, but they knew it would happen, and they planned accordingly. And one of his best friends is a guy called Alex Hawke from New South Wales, and he had the numbers stored in his laptop for months of who stood where. And it was pretty easy to work out, you know, depending on what the debates were. When same-sex marriage was on, it was easy to tell who was on whose side or on the energy debate. And then they would, like Ben Morton would suddenly appear. Ben Morton was also a very close friend of Morrison's. He would suddenly appear out of the blue in backbencher's office and say, "Well, how do you think things are going? How do you think the Prime Minister's looking? What's your feeling about where things are heading?" And they would call that the thermometer check. Mm. So, and all this, you know, is pretty important intelligence in the sense of, you know, where people might end up. And then certainly in those days beforehand, when the Telegraph telegraphed Dutton's move, they knew that something would happen in the next few days. And they all met at Morrison's apartment that he shared with Steve Irons and Stuart Robert, who were his chief numbers men. They met on Sunday night and then again on Monday morning, and pretty much decided that the Dutton camp would pull something on that week, whether it would be ministers resigning to create a sense of crisis or whether Dutton himself put his hand up. And on Monday, Stuart Robert spent a fair bit of his time ringing around backbenchers saying, "Turnbull's terminal. Dutton is not the one to lead us. You should be looking at Morrison." So that would not have helped Turnbull's vote the next day in the party room.
I think it was with Stuart Robert that Scott Morrison prayed in his office right before they went into the party room for the ballot. It was the last,
the final ballot, yes,
that they did, and they prayed that righteousness would exalt the nation, from Proverbs 14:34. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. This is new, I think, in Australian politics. I mean, that we've had several prime ministers in the last decade where their faith has been absolutely up and centre: Kevin Rudd, Tony Abbott, and now Scott Morrison. But there's something very, very different in the way Morrison is is going about that relationship with the public that seems to be working absolutely brilliantly for him. And I, even the fact that we would know, that we could come to know what he prayed about. And I think you asked this question in the book, what that would have meant, what that prayer would have meant if Dutton had won. talk around that a bit, how you...
Well, I had heard the whisper that they had prayed together in the office beforehand, and I must admit, you know, I thought it was quite unusual. I've never heard of anything like that before. But they are, this group is part of a regular prayer group inside the Parliament. They meet every Tuesday when Parliament sits and they pray together.
There's about 10 in the group, is that
right? About 10 of them, yes. And so when I was interviewing Robert, I asked him, you know, what did you pray about? And that's when he told me, you know, righteousness exalts the nation. And I said, well, would it be righteous if Morrison won? And, you know, that was the answer that he gave. So obviously, yes.
All thought, the Prime Minister's prayers seem to be coming true. So I'm thinking of... converting.
Somebody is up there listening.
Judaism is just not rocking my boat at the moment. Maybe I should try something else. But it is it's remarkable, isn't it, that, you know, to have a Prime Minister, I will burn for you. He described people as in us, as agents of God's love. The entire election campaign was, I mean, I felt it was a truly American-style campaign with just him front and centre, nobody else to be seen, but also that God was front and centre. And I think in a way that is quite new for Australian politics, but am I forgetting my history, Nikki?
No, I thought it was too, which is why I wrote about it, really, because I thought it was something that we hadn't seen before. Particularly, I think it was brought home to me on Easter Sunday when he allowed the cameras into his church to film him praying. And it was a very different kind of prayer group meeting from what I think most of us are accustomed to anyway. It's very active, interactive, and I'd never seen pictures of a prime minister like that before. We'd seen Kevin Rudd used to hold doorstops outside St John's Church in Canberra on a Sunday after he'd attended church. That was a very American thing to do.
He was criticised for it in a way that Morrison isn't.
Mm. He was criticised for it because people thought that he was using his religion to further his political ambition. And initially I was talking to people in the Labor Party about what Morrison had done. And they were saying to me that their research was showing that Morrison was coming across as a bit of a Bible basher, which, you know, Australians not accustomed to and are a bit suspicious of, let's face it. But after the campaign was over, when I spoke to people again, they thought that it was quite clever on his part that he did that, because it sent a message to people of faith: you're safe with me, you can trust me. And there was some initial research that has been done by the ANU in seats with high Christian populations, and they found that the swing to the Liberal Party in those seats was much higher than elsewhere. Even in places like, if I can mention George Christensen, the member for Manila who spent more time in Manila than he did in Mackay, he had one of the biggest swings in the country to him of around 11%, and he has a very high Christian population in his electorate. Okay, part of that would have been because of coal, right, because of the Adani coal mine and Bob Brown's coal convoy, etc. But a part of it, not all of it, can be attributed to that. And they think that a fair whack of it was because of faith.
Kevin Rudd gave a really interesting interview on 7:30, actually, I think the week after the election, where he talked about this too, that again, you know, the failure of the, you know, our state and, you know, much New South Wales and the coastal belt to understand that, particularly in Queensland, but Christians in Queensland and elsewhere as well, that I thought his remarks were really interesting. I don't know, you know, perhaps it was Abbott's prayer as well, I suppose, that in the end he only maybe perhaps prayed to get rid of Turnbull and forgot to keep going on with what he wanted after that.
You can
that.
Only but ask for so much,
yeah,
can't
maybe,
you?
Maybe. The overall, you know, the destruction that it caused, the what you describe, the MPs going through and senators after these events is, it's really upsetting. It was actually really upsetting to read. I felt particularly affected by the way you described Christopher Pyne, the effect that this had on him, that, you know, he said that he had not cried as much since his father died and couldn't stop crying and cried, left the building that day crying, was in a taxi to the airport crying all the way there, that he was just distraught and it seems didn't really get over it, that he was compelled to leave. Tell us more about what, you know, what happened to these people after their act of self-destruction.
Yeah, well, it was traumatic for so many of them. And I made a deliberate decision to speak to them as soon as possible after the event. And I did begin interviewing people on the Saturday after the vote because I wanted their recollections to be raw. I didn't want them to allow time to pass so that they could, you know, second-guess themselves or maybe do a little bit of revisionism. So I spoke to Christopher quite early on after it happened, and he was completely devastated because he had never voted for anyone other than Turnbull in a ballot, and he so admired him. And basically thought that the others were pygmies, you know, even though he was instrumental in getting the votes for Morrison to take over, it was only because they feared Dutton so much that they enabled Morrison to get up, but it wasn't because of any great love or affection for Morrison. It was a purely pragmatic decision. So, and even when I was interviewing him in his office, he was starting to choke up when he was talking about it again. But he wasn't the only one. I interviewed Kelly O'Dwyer as well, who also ended up leaving Parliament. And Kelly was a great admirer of Julie Bishop's. And had to tell Julie Bishop, you know, as much as I admire you, I can't vote for you because I fear that if I vote for you, I will get Dutton, and I can't do that for Victoria because we will get wiped out. So I have to vote for Morrison. And she went to Julie's office after the vote to speak to her staff and to try to console them and, you know, tell them why she'd done what she'd done. And then when I was interviewing her in her office as well, the tears were just spilling over when she was going through it all. And then after about an hour, she said, Oh, it doesn't feel so bad now. It was like therapy, you know. It was good to be able to sort of tell the story and try to get it off her chest a bit. But like I say, they were not alone. Anne Rustin from South Australia was so disappointed with what Michaela Cash had done for betraying Turnbull that she walked into Michaela's office and said to her receptionist, "Please tell her that I am so disappointed in what she has done to us," and burst into tears and then left the office. Mm.
We better talk about Corman, because his role in this too was really, really, quite wicked, really, wasn't it? I suppose. I think he was the only person who wouldn't speak to you for the book. Is that right?
One of the few. Greg Hunt wouldn't speak to me either. I spoke to Corman. I used to speak to Corman quite regularly, and also to Dutton, and they were essential to Malcolm's survival. And I thought, if at any point I detected any movement from either of them away from Malcolm, then obviously that would be a very bad sign for his leadership. So every now and again I would say, well, how are things looking? Are you still, you know, still think you're going to take him to the election, etc.? And I spoke to Corman on the Monday before that first Tuesday vote, when all the speculation was around. And I asked him the question again, are you going to stick with Malcolm? And he said, yes, I am. I've spoken about it to my wife, and we've agreed that if Malcolm goes, I'm going to go. I won't stay in Parliament. I'll go down with the ship. And I said, right, so you're going to stick with him until the bitter end, are you? Yes, he said, the bitter end.
Hmm. Was that the greatest betrayal to Turnbull?
Turnbull certainly thinks so. And he thinks that if Corman had stuck, he might have been able to see through the week. And if he'd been able to see through that week, he might have been able to last long enough to go to an election. Dutton's campaign actually began to falter after that Tuesday vote, because it was obvious that although he got 35 votes, probably 10 of those votes were Morrison people. And they voted for Dutton to boost Dutton's vote and to ensure that once Turnbull was down, he could never get up.
Which is exceptional planning.
It was, I tell you what, they were so well organised. They were much better organised than Dutton was, and also obviously much better organised than Malcolm himself. But they planned everything down to the nth degree. They had forewarning. They knew that ballot papers were going to be issued that morning for a vote. So they knew something could happen, and they knew that not too many of them could vote for Dutton, because they obviously didn't want him to win and knock Turnbull out altogether, but they just wanted the vote to be high enough so that Malcolm was damaged and couldn't recover. It was very clever.
Well, I guess you want someone that clever in charge, don't you? I mean, I'm sure that's the kind of tactics. But, well, yeah, I mean, I do want somebody really clever. Absolutely. I mean, one of the big problems I think with Australian political culture lately is, and in fact Scott Morrison really symbolises this, is the attempt to come across as not clever. The attempt to come across as like everyone else, like Dad in the baseball cap. No, I want people contesting the leaders to show me they're smarter than me. They're smarter than everyone. Yeah, don't you?
I want them to be better than me.
I want that too.
I want them to be better people than me, and I want them to have integrity and decency.
But brains too.
Brains, yes, but you can have both. Like Corman, here's where I think the great disappointment is with Corman, where he pledged that he would stick until the bitter end. Then he has a press conference with Malcolm and stands beside him
and says... Is that the photo? Is that...
That's, yes.
Yep.
It's on the other side. And
photoshopped
says,
out.
Mm. Yeah, but we've run the full photo inside, and says, I will serve him loyally into the future. And 2 hours later betrayed him. And I look at that, and I don't, you know, have been around a long time, okay, and I know that people lie, but I think it's impossible to believe anything that anybody says after they do something like that. Mm. So mm. I think that's the great damage, I think, that's been done to the party and to the people who were there now, that I don't think their word can be trusted.
Is it Dutton? Does he share a flat with Dutton now, Corman?
Yes, they've moved
Dutton
in together.
Like brothers.
They're like brothers.
Isn't that charming?
Well,
and of course, you know, they're still there. So, you know, Abbott's gone. He's been blasted out by the people of his seat in an act that I think...
People of Warringah did what the Liberal Party was too frightened to do.
How's that going to go for Morrison, do you think?
Well, I was interested during the week when Ken Wyatt went out and put forward a program for Indigenous recognition, without saying anything too remarkable, really, except that, you know, it's time we had this serious debate and came to some decision over it. That's what he said. He didn't talk about a third chamber. He didn't talk about, you know, a separate voice or anything like that. And then we had sections of the right coming out and saying, oh, when... The Constitution has to be colourblind. It had nothing to do with colour. It has to do with recognising First Peoples, right? And, you know, spearing off onto the third chamber as a way of undermining what was being proposed. And then within 24 hours, Scott Morrison was forced to say, we're not going to do a third chamber, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do that, and starting to pull back. And the person, one of the people who was most prominent in squashing it down was Peter Dutton.
When you did all the interviews for this book, of course, it was after the leadership change but before the election, and everyone then except Scott Morrison thought, of course, they were going to be wiped out. What is it? I mean, Morrison's intuition, his tactical ability, his campaigning ability, it's been, and you know, it every prayer has come true. You'd have to think the miracle of the election win.
Mm-hmm.
This is a tremendous skill set that I think has probably surprised a lot of people, that how evident it has been. How good is he at the nuts and bolts of policy and politics?
Well, that remains to be seen, and people keep saying to me he's not an ideas man. He's obviously a brilliant campaigner. He's very good on the politics, but again, it's different from governing. It's different from leading a team of, you know, disparate personalities and political views. And he was brilliant on the campaign trail because it was just him. And he, you know, they had the script all set. All he had to do was follow the script day after day after day. And he was incredibly disciplined. And the Liberal Party itself also ran a very good ground campaign. They ran a very good advertising campaign. So all those things came together. Now, you might say, well, that's the easy bit. And in certain respects it is the easy part. The hard part is governing. And we haven't seen too much of that yet. And I thought it was a bad sign last week when, as I say, Ken Wyatt was sent out there. Not sent out there, but he would have had the full imprimatur of the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister's office to say what he said. And then within a matter of 2 days to have that pulled back, I thought was not a good sign. I think if you're going to embark on an exercise like that, which obviously is going to have a lot of pitfalls connected to it, you have to have a much better strategy mapped out. How are you going to do it? How are you going to prosecute it? And the leader has to run the debate. You know, Ken Wyatt, yes, it was good that he started it, but Morrison was nowhere to be seen on it.
Do you think, for what it's worth, to ask the question that Turnbull would have won the election?
I do. He would have won it differently. I think he probably learned a lot from 2016. It would have been a much shorter campaign. The ground campaign that the Liberals ran would have been the same. The advertising campaign would have been the same. They would have had the very highly negative campaign against Shorten. Shorten would have become the issue and Shorten's policies and the risks that were posed. He would not have been as disciplined as Morrison, I don't think. There would have been times he probably would have veered off track a bit, but in the overall scheme of things, I don't think it would have mattered that much. I think he would have done better in Victoria. I think the Liberals probably would have held on to Corangamite and Dunkley, so they would have had another 2 seats here, and they still would have won the seats in Tasmania because they were in play well before Morrison came on the scene. That was the polling that Turnbull kept referring to, the marginal seat polling that showed that he was ahead. And they probably would have re-won Lindsay in New South Wales and regained Herbert. Now, he wouldn't have got those huge swings in Queensland that Morrison did, but that made seats more secure, didn't win more seats. And Morrison, at the end of it all, ended up with one more seat than Turnbull had in 2016, and I think that Turnbull would have, if they had let him be, the question is, would they have let him be? Probably not.
Given all that, I mean, it feels like very much now that since the day, morning after the election, I don't know whether it's just exhaustion from sort of everyone, including the media of the last decade, but that a line has been drawn under, I mean, the fact that the leadership change just didn't seem to impact on the coalition at all, compared to Kevin Rudd, Julia Gillard. It feels like this is being treated very much like a first-term government, and that Morrison, depending on how he goes, of course, but, you know, in the great Australian tradition of giving first-term governments a second chance, would go into the next election probably quite confident. Of course, who knows what's going to happen. But what's your reading of that, and or whether the residual damage, there's damage we can't see from all of this at all?
Well, I think the enmities are still there. Morrison was not before a very popular figure inside the parliamentary party. I make the point in the book that Dutton actually has more friends across the political divide than Morrison does. Morrison is not an especially well-liked figure inside the Liberal Party. They like him a bit better now because he won the election. but I doubt that that will last. Cormann and Dutton have never had a very high opinion of him. They've had quite a few rough dealings. I wrote about a lunch that Cormann and Porter and Keenan and others were at, where they compared the different personalities. And the point that they made was that, apart from Keenan calling Morrison an absolute asshole, they thought that he was not a team player. So I think he needs to learn how to manage people better.
Keenan's gone too, of course, now. So
Keenan's gone too, and so has Chobo. And like I say, I mean, those events had a huge impact on people inside the party and made them feel a lot differently about politics and about their colleagues. It was no accident that they left. You know, I always get very suspicious when they say that they want to spend more time with the family because that's another dead giveaway, I reckon.
If you would like to ask a question, please just raise your hand and we'll get a mic to you.
Hi. Fascinating learning about the inside. Thank you, Nikki. Look, when Turnbull put his hand up for the Prime Ministership, I personally was very confused, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but I understood that Turnbull was fighting a good fight to separate us from Queen and country and become a republic, and all of a sudden he turns out to be a figurehead for the Liberal Party. Did he seek leadership for the wrong party?
Well, there are people in the Liberal Party who think that, of course. I think it's different. He was leader of the Liberal Party, and the Liberal Party is a very different kind of beast. So, and he was quite constrained in what he could do. And I think, you know, it's making a deal with the devil, if you like. That there are things that he wasn't allowed to freelance on, and the Republic was one of them.
Not that there aren't plenty of Republicans in the Liberal Party, of course, but yeah.
There are, but, you know, the he would not have had the party on side if one of his first actions was to go out there and say, I'm going to go full steam ahead on you know, another republic referendum.
What was Shorten's policy? 100 days and we'd have a plan to a republic? We're almost at 100 days,
and
aren't we?
And a series of plebiscites.
Yeah. Next.
Simple question. I still think that Dutton is the underlying snake, and he's and that thing about with Kevin Wyatt is probably an example. Why and how is he so popular across the bench?
He's very popular with the base of the Liberal Party, and a lot of the stuff that he does is to keep the base on side. So, and the base of the Liberal Party is very different from the voting membership of the Liberal Party, if you like. So he, you know, everything he does is geared to play to that. And also he's, like I say, he has behind the scenes a very engaging personality. I know this is difficult to comprehend, but he's and he reminds me in some respects of Keating. I'm not saying, you know, politically, but in his dealings with people, he is very upfront. He's very frank. You always know where you stand with him. You know, there's no BS with him. He'll tell you exactly where he's coming from. And they like him. They relate to him.
The thing about Keating, though, is that he's exactly the same in person as he is in public. I mean, it's just the same human being. Whereas Dutton, in the book, I really got the sense that he really feels a bit sorry for himself that he's so misunderstood by the general public, that there's this sweet, lovely man that, you know, he's not, clearly not the same person that he's presenting. When you hear his colleagues in there, his friends talk about the sweet is the word that I remember, and this is just not something that is
that
coming
comes across
for him.
Well, I always used to say to him, if you want to be leader, you have to get out of the immigration portfolio. To my mind, that is the most difficult portfolio for a Liberal minister, and because you have to be the hard man all the time. So I always thought it would have been better for him if he'd been able to shift out of that, so that he could talk about other things and show another side, but he never did it, and then it was too late.
He comes across to me in here as somebody who wants to give people, you know, what he thinks they want for his end. So he talks in there about, was it an election strategy where he said, you know, I'd go hard on law and order and I'd go for the older voters, and he had it all plotted out rather than any sense in there of this is what this country needs. I mean, there was not one line in this entire book where anybody talked about what this country needs. And Dutton sort of symbolises that to me.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And that was Morrison as well. I don't think Morrison offered really much of a prescription for what he wanted to do or where he wanted to take the country. And it seems that he's, you know, trying to cobble it all together now.
We have no idea. I mean, there's tax cuts and we're God's agents.
No, but... well, maybe God will decide. But he got there. It's like, you know, the classic movie, The Candidate, where he gets elected and he says, well, what do we do now? So I think that's where we're at.
Your assessment that Morrison is probably the most clever or smartest politician in this generation, I'm thinking back to when he was running Australian Tourism Commission, the ATC, and he came up with that campaign, Where the Bloody Hell Are You?, which was an absolute monumentally bad disaster. And then he appeared in Parliament holding a lump of coal. So I think that maybe we need to reassess that assessment. My question is, though, Shorten lost the election. I don't think Morrison really won it. So can you please talk a little bit more about Shorten's shortcomings? Thank you.
Well, Morrison, for someone who was only elected to Parliament in 2007, has come a hell of a long way, I think, to be able to organise it so that he could be elected leader in the space of a few short years, and then to win the election. And it wasn't just because Shorten was hopeless, but it was also because of the way that he presented as well. I mean, he was smart enough to know what he had to do to get there, and he did it. So that's why I think I describe him as astute. He's very clever in that way. So I think you have to hand it to him that, you know, that he actually managed to pull it off. And then you contrast that with Shorten, and how could it be that Labor could not make the case against a party that had had three prime ministers in 3 years? Why were they not capable of saying, you know, this mob is divided and dysfunctional, and you know the last thing they're thinking about is you, the people. They have no policies, they have no prescriptions, but he was completely incapable of running that case against Morrison, and Morrison just kept running away from him. So it was the two things. It was Morrison himself running a very good campaign and Shorten just being absolutely hopeless.
We're going to have to very soon see images of our Prime Minister having a fancy dinner in the White House with the Vulgarian. And I'm wondering how Scott Morrison might manage that. How do you think he will do that? How should he do it? I mean, I don't know how you could do it. I just don't know how you could accept a dinner invitation in that place from that man right now, particularly right now.
Well, he's the president. You have to deal with him. Well, you have to find a way of dealing with him, right?
Do you anymore? Do you think there could come a point where you could just politely decline and say you've got important business like figuring out some policies to make your country wonderful again?
Because he could do enormous damage to Australia. He could impose tariffs on steel again for no good reason if we managed to...
fear. There'd be fear in... I mean, I guess there is, isn't there, with all of them, but...
Well, there's fear. I don't know whether it's fear so much, but it's just this realisation you have to find a way to be able to work with him, right, so that you get out of him what you need without being blind to... you know, his many faults and foibles and general madness. You know, we have to deal with him. He's going to be there probably for another 4 years, so...
Six.
We can't ignore him.
I agree.
Can't be ignored.
I agree about that. I think there's something different about going through those formalities, I suppose. I just don't even know how I'll cope seeing the imagery of that and... it'll be interesting to see how Scott Morrison deals with dealing with the optics of that, I suppose.
Well, he has to deal with him in a very professional way. I don't think he has any choice. I mean, you can't spurn the invitation, you can't ridicule him, you have to treat him, you know, as if he was a normal person. because we have, it's our most, regardless of everything, it's our most important alliance, and we have to stay in communication. We don't have to be his best friend. But at the moment it seems like we're his only friend, which is another worry in itself. It's not like he's got too many, but this is where we are.
Following an election where nobody made a memorable speech or even a memorable phrase about even a subtle, just a little nuance about a little nod to the world we are living in right now and Australia's place in it and where Australia might be able to just be better, you know. I find that really worrying and terribly sad. Oh, that's a bit of a sad note to end on, isn't it? I'm sorry.
It's not
to,
a happy tale.
Yeah, no, well, it's not. But exciting times for the coalition, Nikki, and exciting times for you. The book, it really is... terrific. Congratulations on the book. And if you don't have the two of them, bring them together. They're a wonderful, wonderful duo. Any more from you? Are you a trilogy? I always think three is better than two.
Right. Well, something would need to happen for me to do another
I think you might have cursed us all. I'm sure it will, because I'd love another book. That'd be great. Congratulations. Thank you so much. And thank you all for coming.
Yes,
it really
thank you
is
all
a
for coming.
Hundreds of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sally.
Nikki Sever and Sally Warhaft, recorded in front of a live audience on Tuesday, the 16th of July, 2019. This series comes to you from the Wheeler Centre, Melbourne's home for conversations about books, writing and ideas. Check us out at wheelercentre.com. And until next time, take care.